Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad.
I'm Brian Foster, and this is the Grindhouse Institute. On each episode of this podcast, Jeremy Floyd and I program a triple feature movie night. Each of the movies share common themes, and we discuss them here. We're happy you could join us for today's block we call Inspiring the Matrix. Your favorite sunglass-wearing, white rabbit-following, leather daddies at the grindhouse lay back, take some pills, and jack into another Zoom call to explore the films that the Wachowskis hacked in order to create their magnum opus, The Matrix. When the technical director of a sophisticated computer simulation dies mysteriously, Fred Stilla must take over the program and discover the nature of his predecessor's untimely demise and increasingly bizarre occurrences he encounters. Is he going mad, or is he trapped within another simulation? Klaus Lowitzsch stars in Rainer Werner Fassbinder's World on a Wire from 1973. An elite police assault team led by Major Motoko Kusanagi is on the trail of a powerful hacker that can not only take control of computer systems, but also people's minds. Major and the entire police force pull out all the stops to hunt down this puppet master, but what if that's exactly what he wanted? This is Mamoru Oshii's Ghost in the Shell from 1995. Corporate software engineer by day, elite industrial goth hacker by night, Thomas A. Anderson has his mundane existence turned upside down when another hacker, Morpheus, offers to let him eat his choice of drugs right out of his hands, either a red or a blue pill. Lawrence Fishburne teaches air breathing and Keanu Reeves learns kung fu in the Wachowskis' The Matrix from 1999. Thank you for listening to the Grindhouse Institute. Please enjoy.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
I tried to watch the new Matrix movie, sort of also in preparation for this episode, and I got through about 5 minutes of it and thought I was watching the old movie again. Like, I was really confused. Did you see it, either of you?
No.
I went to the theaters with my parents on opening day. Saw it in IMAX.
Cool.
I gotta say, in its defense, because, you know, it's objectively a bad movie.
Right.
But in its defense, you know, a lot of times you're watching a bad movie and you have that myth in your mind. It's like, well, let's keep it going. Maybe it gets better. And it almost never does. Matrix actually does get better as it goes along.
Oh, okay.
But actually, you know, like right around the back half of the second act, it finally decides to come up with a plot for the entire movie. And that plot itself is like, okay, pretty cool. I think it would have been better as like a three-part miniseries or two-part miniseries.
Yeah.
On German television?
On German television in the 1970s, yeah. I think that format might have been a little bit more apropos.
It's no longer Neo. It's Christopher Nobody.
Like it sticks to the landing better than any other horrible movie I've ever seen.
Okay. Says Peter Travers of Rolling Stone magazine.
Christopher Nobody. Christopher. No. Christopher Nobody.
What's a simulated experience again?
Well, all your memories about your wife and daughter are false. They're like a dream. Someone's taken advantage of you. They were trying to make you ghost hack into some government officials. Do you understand what I'm saying?
You go by the hacker alias Neo and are guilty of virtually every computer crime we have a law for. We know that you've been contacted by a certain individual. Man who calls himself Morpheus.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
This can't be.
Be what?
be real?
All right, welcome back to the Grindhouse Institute. I'm Brian Foster, and with me as always is Jeremy Floyd. Hello, and how are you?
Mr. Fosterson, you disappoint me. I expected you to be taking out your landlady's garbage.
You help her cross the street. What's in that file that Agent Smith has there in front of him? Is it literally just pictures of him taking garbage across the street with his landlady? Yeah, he's got everything. And it wasn't that thick either. It's only about that big.
Yeah. He didn't have it on a zip drive, so it was weird.
It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
Well, today we're going to be talking about some more cyberpunk-type stuff with a very special guest today. Very excited to have the special guest with us. Jeremy, would you mind doing the introduction?
Yeah, so we've already touched on some cyberpunk, and we've also touched on the sort of 90s nihilism with this guest, so we had to bring him back to dive into the Matrix. Welcome back, Chris Michael.
Heyo, that's me.
That's you.
I've been here the whole time. Did people know that?
No.
There's like a door.
It's not like the Smartless podcast where they don't show the guest right away, and that's Jerry Seinfeld.
Now, guys, it is me, Chris Michael. Good to be here. Glad to be here. Appreciate you both. Appreciate this audience, all of you.
You can hear him cheering.
Hell of a lineup we have going here. We were talking about a little bit before. We're going to be talking about films that are inspirations for The Matrix, one of my all-time favorite movies growing up. Today, we're going to be talking about World on a Wire from 1973, Ghost in the Shell from 1995, and The Matrix from 1999. Hard-hitting, cyberpunk all the way, and three very different versions of cyberpunk, I'd say, that all kind of share a few things, and I'm sure we'll get into that in this podcast.
Yeah. Well, as a way to little kind of kick it off, I want to talk about a subject that came up with The Matrix, and then that'll kind of maybe take us into this thing, which is, I think, we do this thing where we always assume in movies like The Terminator and The Matrix, the machines sort of want something, that their behavior is there to fulfill a need. And why? Because, well, that's what we do. That's a human thing, to perceive things that way. However, all they're doing is sort of executing the programming. They are algorithmically bound to pursue these things as the programming dictates. You know, they don't want anything. They're just machinery mindlessly grinding away. And in much the same way, the fervor and the arms race in the U.S. Clamored to sort of stop the Soviets in the second half of the 20th century. All that sort of machinery was built up in a post-World War II empire. And this machine was sold to Americans as a way to stop the existential threat of communism. But what happens when there's no more justification for such a war machine? And we found out in the 1990s. The wall fell, the USSR collapsed, and the machine continued humming along. And, you know, that's because that's all it was going to do ever. The machine was on, Skynet was actualized. we couldn't hit the off switch for many reasons, including the fact that everything was sort of melded in together with the machine. I don't know if that's the most accurate to say we couldn't have turned it off, but it would have taken so much more to do than just the metaphor of hitting the off switch. Anyhow, to keep that going, sort of by the 90s, we arrived at the point that Francis Fukuyama described as the end of history. You know, capitalism had won, communism had lost. There were no more worlds to conquer. This was the system, and there's nothing else to it. Do not try to picture anything different. You can't, because this is the final stage. It is, hence, the end of history. And I think this was very much expressed in the popular culture of the 90s. That Gen X nihilism that we talked about on previous episodes with you, Chris, we touched on it just a little bit, but I think here it's in full effect. There's sort of this inarticulate sense that everything is going wrong. You can't see the machinery. You can't get to the gears and circuitry, but something's not right. And you see that in music, like alt rock music, like Nine Inch Nails, Nirvana, Rage Against the Machine, Smashing Pumpkins. The world is a vampire and it's set to drain. I mean, even in the music videos, things like Everybody Hurts, right? The REM song. Think about how that thing sort of the machinery breaks down on the freeway and everyone sort of, you know, is left wandering. What do we do now? Mm-hmm. But I think especially you see all this stuff in the cultural zeitgeist of 90s movies. And in particular, the sort of 18 months leading up to the change of the millennium. You know, 1999, I think, has been talked about a bunch in sort of movie circles as this, like, you know, crazy year for a lot of really great movies that came out that year. But I think in this context, it's really interesting to look at it. You know, you have a lot of movies sort of expressing this sort of cultural anxiety, even in things like Office Space, Fight Club, American Beauty. All of those were sort of talking about the death of the soul that otherwise looks like a normal American life. You also have Existenz, the, oh my God, what's his name?
David Cronenberg.
Cronenberg film. And the sort of American remake of World on a Wire called The 13th Floor. Both of those are sort of expressing this undercurrent of a virtual world that we can't really distinguish from reality. I could even go as far as say something like Magnolia, is an example of, you know, something where it shows a hidden network underneath the surface that we can't see, and sort of the way it ends sort of undermines the idea of our sort of normal humdrum lives. And even if you stretch this 1999 back a little bit further, you get things like Pi and The Truman Show, which sort of, like, you know, show that anxiety of the hidden machinery that sort of shaping and controlling our lives. And then, of course, we get The Matrix, the sort of one that sort of most strongly connected, I think, with our collective imaginations on this subject of this anxiety. I think of like the way that we all, especially at that time, you know, could feel that there was, you know, something amiss with this diagnosis of the end of history, but, you know, didn't know what that was. And this movie, I think, really, really touched a nerve there, even more so than some of those other movies that came out the same year. And when we get into The Matrix itself, I think we'll dive into some more of that. But as an interesting way to sort of kick this off, wanted to kind of talk about some of that and how, you know, the Matrix was sort of the movie of the 90s. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It embodied everything that decade was sort of building up to.
We need to delay these shows more often. I mean, that was a nice little intro by Jeremy. He probably had some time to work on that.
Yeah, I'm just relieved that we're having this culminate in the Matrix movie, because that diatribe could have very easily culminated in like us talking about QAnon and what's happening right now. So let's definitely stay in the 90s in our mind as well for this discussion, because things have gotten scarier since, I think, in a lot of ways.
It's gotten worse.
No, exactly. I mean, like, that's the thing, though. It's that hasn't really left us. And the way that The Matrix ends, The Matrix 1 ends, is like a perfect example of like how, you know, the movie and like the decade felt like it was going to be progressing forward somewhere. And then, you know, of course, you know, 9/11 and then the, you know, 2008 crash and all these other things, you know, just like kind of slide us all the way back into this pit of sadness from the never ending story that we're stuck in at the moment. And, you know, those things with, you know, you're talking about QAnon and everything else, everyone's trying to make sense of this crazy world, and they're reaching for crazier and crazier explanations. Flat Earth, you know, you name it.
The Clintons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, not only 9/11 happening shortly after The Matrix, Columbine happening shortly after The Matrix. Mm-hmm. Right, it was a big discussion point at that time, and I think The Matrix, I think, was kind of America's last guilt-free gun fest. Right, I mean, for some
coming
people, you know, 40% of people, there's guilt-free gun fests every day, but in terms of the collective America, the unified America, getting off on gun violence without having to deal with the consequences, you know, I mean, being able to just put up a hand and have all the bullets stop, and not being facing the consequences of violence. It is kind of a hallmark of that fetishization without consequence.
Because when you reach your full potential, you won't need to dodge bullets, right? You could, right. You won't need to. Yeah.
You won't need to. Yeah. That's interesting too, because like you get this idea of like, okay, it's all a simulated reality, so there's no consequences. You can just blow away whoever you want. It is interesting though that like in the guilt-free gun violence idea, sticking with that for a second, like what the movie perceives of as the bad guys versus post 9/11 and post things like Columbine and everything else. Popular culture doesn't express the bad guys being these authority figures the way that it does in The Matrix.
Yeah, it kind of shifted the bad guys to being about the others again. It's like 80s, the bad guys were the others, mm-hmm. more so. You saw some, I mean, I guess Terminator was in 80s, but.
Well, and I think that that's a perfect thing too. It's like, you know, this is this like perfect sort of post-Cold War, pre-9/11. We don't have an enemy in our popular imaginations at this time. There isn't just like, oh, the capital C communist hiding under every bed. And, you know, they're in the closet with a knife in their teeth, ready to spring out on grandma. You know, that image is gone. So who the hell is to blame for how miserable everybody feels, right? And it's like the movie sort of was able to turn to those things. Whereas, you know, after 9/11, okay, we were able to crystallize, oh, there's terrorism, that they hate freedoms and things. And, you know, you're able to then disperse the anxieties and fears and the hatred into that vessel of the other, like you were saying. Yeah, that's a good point.
And no larger cultural motivation to really go after an other, right? In the same way that we, at least there was a little bit, seemingly a bubble of time in which we weren't beating the drums of war against racial divides and national divides to the same degree that people have found profit in doing so again now.
Right.
But also, I mean, we were like, what, teenagers then. So maybe we were just ignorant to all that going on, but.
Yeah. And some of the sort of channels and monetary incentives and things like that weren't there for that at the time, even though there was, you know, the internet. This is all 1.0 internet at this time.
I mean, we just had the first Christmas since then in which the United States has not been at war. This was the first Christmas in 20 years.
Yeah, I guess technically, right. How crazy is that to think of that? Like,
yeah.
You know, we've been in Afghanistan ever since The Matrix came out, essentially, more or less.
And around that same time, I mean, it was like, you know, Lord of the Rings, the Star Wars prequels. So, and I think, you know, even though like Mel Gibson movies were calling that were popular in that time were like nostalgic others hatred, right? It was like, mm-hmm. remember when we hated the English?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that The Patriot?
Or Braveheart? Or
Braveheart. Yeah. Oh, right, yeah. Right. Sorry, yeah.
Both of them.
Maybe we should probably get into World on a Wire here and start.
Let's get into it because it's an ordeal.
Yeah, was it an ordeal to watch? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Just for people that don't know this movie, it was part of a serialized two-parter on German television in 1973. Mm-hmm. We got to enjoy all 3.5 hours of it each individually. I watched it in pieces, and I didn't feel so bad about it because it was technically a TV movie, and I took a day off in between two halves.
Yeah.
But it definitely fits with what we're talking about today. And I have been wanting to talk about this movie with you guys since watching it. It was an interesting one, and it really captivated me, to be honest. You might say it was a slog to get through. However, I thought it was very interesting, and a very interesting ride overall.
I think this one, yeah, I really do want to talk with you guys and hear your thoughts, because this was a perfect movie to watch with a group to be able to comment. And there's certainly, like, you're not going to miss much by talking through it because, one, it doesn't matter the audio because you're reading it unless you're a German speaker. But, yeah, the pace of it, I think, from being made for TV in the 70s, and I think the director was kind of well-known for taking his time and being a mm-hmm. bit melodramatic. Fassbender, is that how you pronounce the mm-hmm. director's
yeah.
name? Prolific filmmaker, like, made, what, 40 or 50 films. I should have done my research a little bit better.
Yeah, he made 40 films in 15 years and died at age 37.
Three films a year there.
Yeah, and like absolutely crazy nuts. Death too. He had like contacted his friend and was like, I'm done with drugs. I flushed them all. Just one last celebration line of coke. And I'm
let's mix it all at once. Yeah. And cocaine and barbiturates out the door.
That's apparently what did him in was that last line of cocaine. Which smacked of Philip K. Dick, right? Of like continually challenging his own reality while depicting challenges to reality in his art. But for me, I'd say watch it in a group, or what I did to help me get through it, because it is closed caption for non-German speakers, watch it at double speed because it is so slow. You can read in the amount of time that those captions are on. So there was probably the middle third of it that I watched at double speed. I have to admit.
It definitely takes its time, but it felt like it took its time in the way that like movies like Clockwork Orange and Possession take their time. And it was one of those that really got me hooked right from the get-go. I immediately knew that something was off, that the world was not what we were seeing in front of us, that there was something in the background that was always going on. It felt like there was just waves being made, but you never really knew what was happening. And I thought that they did a really good job of portraying that. The main character, not the most likable of main characters, in my opinion. However, what's that? Fred Stiller. However, I thought he did a fantastic job and really conveyed the type of anxiety that you'd be feeling, not knowing exactly when and where you are in space at any one time. And then the way that the layers just started coming down on him by the end of the film, I thought was interesting. However, I don't think that this one stuck the landing as well as you say the Matrix Resurrections might have stuck the landing, but we can get into that.
Well, I mean, by that sticking landing, I mean it was like
it wasn't
tumbling
terrible
down the freeway and managed to like get up to a knee before it was the curtains closed.
They actually had the end on screen at the end, so you knew it was over.
Oh, it's over now.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
We got it.
The worst after credits sequence any film has ever had. The after credits scene of The Matrix Revolutions. You're in for a treat.
Okay. Well, The Resurrections, though, the new one, right?
The new one, yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. Check it out.
Jeremy, your initial overall impressions, World on a Wire.
So it was interesting. The movie played like sort of a film noir, but underwater or something, where you're just like things are really moving slow. Like you think about that early on. There's that sort of indoor pool party.
Where the hell was that?
Yeah, which was the weirdest. I mean, I thought for sure that we were in the simulation then, and obviously, the film plays into like that there's a simulated universe, Simulacrum, which is this company created this universe for marketing purposes of all the things to do with this. It's to inform marketing decisions for
a
super powered focus group of 10,000 simulated people living in a closed environment.
It's quite literally like the 1973 version of the metaverse.
Right. Totally. Yeah, exactly.
Based on a novel from 1964. And there's definitely like, you know, there's some 60s delusionment going on. I'm very curious to know, not knowing anything about Berlin in the 70s and Germany in the 70s, how much of that culture we're supposed to see in there, or how much it is supposed to be just brutally slapsticky obvious that the quote unquote real world that Stiller thinks he's in initially, until he realizes that he's just in one layer of unknown amount of layers of simulated worlds. Is the audience supposed to be there too? Because at that party, it's like there's no way that this goofiness is reality.
Well, that was when his counterpart disappeared, right? Out of nowhere, was at that pool party, right? So that was when we found out or got our first taste of people, or the IDUs, I believe they called it, the like independent units or whatever those people were called. Yeah. Like Einstein was 001, how they were just being deleted from the world and without any question or without any explanation with any of the other IDU units in the world, you know, that person is just gone. And so even though they're thinking rationally as, you know, they're programmed to think, I think that You get kind of lost, but that was technically in the world, and so no one really reacted around him like, oh, person disappeared. Somebody would probably react to that.
Yeah, but not if they're all NPCs. So it's like
NPCs.
Their reactions to disappearance was not scripted, and so therefore it's
exactly
not done.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, but what was so wild, and like, you know, I hadn't seen this one before, and you know, I had a feeling where it was going to go, just because I know it was sort of kind of an inspiration for The Matrix, but. Mm-hmm. In this world, it actually played a lot like Inception.
Much more like Inception, I think.
Where it was like, yeah, you know, these different layers, mm-hmm, of the Matrix.
Mm-hmm. The technology reminded me of Inception as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like what we perceive as the reality we get to at the end, where we spend the bulk of our time is sort of one layer down, and then there's a second layer down. But anyhow, like... It was one of those things where it's like, you know, it was this film noir underwater. Everything like felt like there was a carbon monoxide leak everywhere. Everyone was just sort of like laying around, like completely like this blank expression.
Feeling
on their
a
faces.
Little slow today.
Or hopping in an office chair for an important meeting with your boss, and then the both of them just spinning around for 20 seconds.
Oh, are you saying you've never done that?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Yeah,
this movie's going to inform all of your office decisions now.
Exactly. but I love how they were playing on a lot of sort of what I imagine the audience for this being sort of West German television in the 70s, playing on the audience's nostalgia for things like the Marlene Dietrich lookalike in that club. And, you know, how sort of odd and uncanny and just sort of emotionless that was, sort of like everything else. I mean, but it's sort of in that way also kind of like Westworld, you know, it's like it has,
sure,
that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of Westworld in there.
Yeah, it's like there's a lot of these nostalgic elements that are sort of meant to play on the people who are in the simulations nostalgia.
Yeah, there's even, he goes into that showing and there's the, you know, the German army show that he's watching with the, mm-hmm, the song. It was the German army, like national patriotic song, and you, mm-hmm, know, smacks of a little bit of fascism and Nazi nostalgia.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to speak about that scene, as well as the scene where he was going to use the telephone, almost like in a Matrix style, to exit the simulation. Mm-hmm. You know, he was waiting for the payphone. The people that were in those scenes were pale faced and had a little bit of rouge on their lips, and it was almost as if, yeah, they were mimish or mannequinish in their presentation, I guess. And I didn't know if that was one of the giveaways, that this was kind of like ID units that were just, you know, not fully fleshed out, and they were just kind of NPCs, like you were saying, like, mm-hmm, they had lower polygon count than, you know, some of the main characters. I just didn't know if you guys had any thoughts on that, if you noticed that or anything, but you saw a lot of that, especially in that German musical that was happening at the end, because I believe everyone there and that was working at that establishment were all that pale-faced, you know, not an active member of the storyline like Westworld, yeah, would be. Instead, they were just kind of people in the background.
Are you talking about when we were in the second level or the third level of the Matrix with the Einstein character? Einstein?
That was when we met Einstein, was when he was trying to use the phone, right?
Yeah, and then, mm-hmm, sort of Varys from Game of Thrones.
Exactly,
in there.
Varys, like, yeah, the, yeah, eunuch.
Yeah. He had his giant pimp coat on. Yeah, exactly. Like, that. Everyone in there, like, we were supposed to be clued in that things were a little different. Like, the fashions were a little different. It wasn't supposed to be the 70s anymore in this,
yeah,
nether world. It was kind of the 30s.
Yeah.
And then we see these, like, really old wrought iron elevators and whatever, which again kind of felt like Inception. I feel like Christopher,
yeah,
Nolan definitely saw this one. You know, you let the mark know they're dreaming, or in this case, I don't know what, simulating. Yeah, the,
right,
old-fashioned elevator, all that stuff.
But didn't they technically call this a dream? Maybe I'm remembering that incorrectly, but in many ways they said that weren't dreams just, and reality that we make of it are just the synapses firing from our brain, you, mm, know, to make reality a thing. And this is the same thing that it's doing. It's just creating that simulacrum through brain activity. Like, Mm-hmm. So maybe this is more of an inspiring Inception. I mean, I felt that way throughout the entire film.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I kept feeling that for sure. And it seemed as if Christopher Nolan had seen this movie. And
you sure, know. He's seen like every movie. Yeah, but he definitely took some inspiration from this one.
Right. And I think even maybe Jonathan Nolan, too, with the Westworld remake.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, you know, the sort of carbon monoxide leak and, you know, everyone just sort of not having human reactions to things. How interesting was that scene, or maybe unintentionally hilarious, is that scene where the woman offers him a cigarette and then he like jumps out of the way.
Yeah, he asks her for light. She says she doesn't smoke. Then he dives out of the way. And we look back, the cinder blocks had come down, which we saw like goofily following him as he had been walking.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the crane. Yeah.
Oh, also, he's like, can I get a light? And I'm not trying to pick you up. And she's like, too bad, which is also like this humdrum poor man's Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford character is with absolutely very little personality beyond irritation.
What about the German James Bond?
Oh, you want to call him the German James Bond? I was going to call him the rental Harrison Ford, but every woman wants him. Every guy seems to want to be him. So yeah, low rent Harrison Ford going for a walk, pulls out a cigarette, sees a woman, says, hey, can I get a light? I just want a light, not trying to pick you up. She says, oh, that's too bad. I would have loved to be picked up by you despite you being a humdrum. And she says, I don't smoke. I don't have a light. He dives out of the air. The cinder block that had been following him around as if it was someone was playing the claw game.
Right.
Drops down, crushes her. No remorse. He picks up a lighter. Turns out, shame on her. She lied about not having a lighter. That
she just wanted an excuse to talk to him for a second. Yeah.
That's what you get.
And he lights a cigarette and walks away, and we never talk about it ever again. So once again, we have like the real world of this film is more surreal than anything we see in the simulated world within the storyline.
I think that's the thing is like, you know, we as the audience are supposed to be like, well, how the hell is this world a thing? You know, like we keep coming back to this club every once in a while. Like that was the Marlene Dietrich club. And then like at one point there's a dance party and it's all black folks and all the men are just these incredible
strapping.
Like bodybuilders.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, wearing no clothing.
And, you know, all the women are also topless. And then we see one of those bodybuilders later is like a chef. He's like,
yeah, he was one of the cooks later.
He's like naked, but in an apron. And he's like, he's a short order cook.
I hope he's not working with a lot of oil.
Yeah, stay away from the deep fryers, man. Yeah,
exactly.
But I think also kind of paints to mirror what you were saying earlier, Brian, about like certain characters being depicted as less than NPCs. You know, there's like,
right.
The NPCs that are quest givers or important NPCs with actual names. And then there's just like guard number three. He's like, I would have been an adventurer too until I took that arrow to the knee.
I used to be an adventurer like you. Then I took an arrow in the knee.
I used to be an adventurer like you. Then I took an arrow in the knee.
I used to be an adventurer like you.
Then I took an arrow in the knee.
So we see that kind of as if it was a video game. We see that there's named NPCs and unnamed NPCs.
It's a great example, yeah. As opposed to, yeah, citizen of Berlin, it is, you know, Hans. Yeah, and he's a named character, right, yeah.
Yeah, and like the contact guy who was the only one within Simulacrum. How are we going to pronounce that?
Simulacrum.
At least that was the German way of saying Simulacrum.
I'm going to call it Simworld from now on.
There you go.
Simworld.
That works.
Yeah.
So within Simworld, there's one character that knows that it's a sim, and he's necessary to kind of be the go-between a bit, right? He's the contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the walls come down of the real world being yet another Simworld, then Stiller becomes obsessed with finding the contact and is kind of accusing everyone within his circle of being the contact to the next layer of the worlds, right? And it's Einstein is the name. So it's like even given this genius name of the contact, and that's, of course, the AI that has a mental health crisis, tries to commit suicide, and then ultimately fights their way into the upper layer of the worlds.
Right.
The first person who does.
By becoming the therapist, right? Wasn't that how Einstein made his way up? Was entering another body or another IDU?
Yeah, he had switched his AI mind with that of somebody from the upper layer.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Wolfgang, the therapist who he did?
I thought it was the therapist, yeah, because then Stiller beat him up, and that was the end of the first half of the right. of the film there. Yeah. When you're kind of given the, okay, you're not in the real world. You haven't been there this whole time. Yeah.
And it's like, you know, but what's funny about having the rug pulled on that moment, it's like, this is something that the audience should have sort of suspected all along, which is that, hey, guess what? Remember how you invented this simulated world of ones and zeros? Turns out you're a part of that. Thus explaining why everybody's sort of dead and hollow, even Stiller and his like sort of zero of a personality. You know, he gets frustrated quite a bit. That's about as much emotion as he shows. I mean,
but he's a hell of an athlete. That guy can sky over fences. Like
he has all these like unnecessarily complicated ways of like climbing up stairs or jumping under railings,
jumping out windows before things blow up. Like,
which I think also speaks to kind of moves like a little kid moves, right? Constantly swinging through a railing, not wanting to jump around steps.
Yeah.
So I think that could have been like either a director or an acting choice to say like, hey, despite this being a grown-up who's apparently at the height of his powers, he moves with the kind of unbridled make my own lane as a child, because he's only probably a year old of existence. So he's still going to have some of that exuberance.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And also, no remorse when he just fires a rifle at a car coming up to his cabin.
Oh, sorry, I didn't know it was you.
Yeah, then why didn't you take the shot?
Yeah, exactly. Just I saw the car come up, and then she just kind of ducked out of the way. Didn't she just disappear at that point, or was she also deleted?
She went into the cabin, and they were chatting for a little bit, and then she walked away, and then he was like, where'd you go? Are you a deer? And then, like...
Right, there was a deer there then, right?
The Matrix gods were trying to kill him with a tree and all this stuff, so...
There was also that dog. Did she become the dog? I don't remember.
Oh, it was a dog. It was a dog.
The sequence of events. There was a dog that kind of came running towards him, and he waist shot like 7 rounds from this rifle.
I just kept picturing one of the people that were in the real world that were trying to, you know, eliminate Stiller were just like sending things at him. You know, like the dog was just like, let's program a dog to go after him. You know, it was almost like, you know, the agent's kind of taken over somebody's body and then now they're chasing. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That one. I thought that's kind of what, as well as the cinder blocks on the crane, you can almost see somebody like with a joystick, like you said, like the claw game.
Like fucking with them.
Somebody's on the top at the computer terminal actually doing that. It's interesting.
Right, kind of like SimCity when you like... voluntarily turn on the tornado or the Godzilla
or the Godzilla creature. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. And we learn that Stiller is, you know, again, the NPC version, the created character for the video game from Stiller of the next layer up of worlds.
Right.
And that is the motivation for the contact who used to love real life Stiller to be looking out for him because she what used to be in love with the real life version.
You're talking about the German Michelle Pfeiffer.
German Michelle Pfeiffer, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah, she was a German Michelle Pfeiffer, wasn't she?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's like it's interesting that they weren't, I guess, trying to sell the second layer of the Matrix here as the real world in any way. And so when it's like, you know, we have all those examples of like things like not making sense in a human context, but making sense in the sort of NPC context, including him finding out like he's kind of like frustrated and he gets, you know, horny for some of these women who come around. But like it's not as if there's any emotional expression that he has or anything that happens to him when he even finds out that this thing called his life isn't real. Right. Like think about how much Neo sort of rejects all that in the Matrix, right? Now, as a choice, I guess that's what they did in this movie to sort of like express how like each layer is even more fake than the previous one. In what we are supposed to think is the real world for the longest time, you know, where we have the carbon monoxide pool parties and you know,
Corvettes popping up out of nowhere.
Yeah, I think
what's your favorite car?
You deserve an upgrade to your car.
Corvette.
you've achieved enough mana points to get a car, and like so, it's like all those things, and then you get to the next layer down, and then you know you have Varys wearing the pimp coat and the lipstick, and like the Einstein with the.
It's a little weirder.
The like German expressionism copy. Makeup and all that stuff from the silent era.
Yeah.
And, you know, like things are just sort of weirder and weirder. And perhaps it's part of that is the that thing that Agent Smith talks about toward the end of The Matrix, where it's like, oh, you know, we tried making the world like this and we tried making it like that. And you guys kept rejecting it and your minds and whatever. And maybe this world is something along those lines where it's like they had to find that perfect balance of like, oh, the simulation's a little different, and the people who are doing the real world of World on a Wire Matrix for sort of market research had to have it just be a little off kilter so that they would know which one's real and which one's not, right?
Which one was potentially created by the IDUs that the people actually created in the real world.
Yeah.
And it's like, all of a sudden they did the same thing in their version of that world. And then it's how it just keeps going down layer by layer by layer. Now, here's my question. By the end of it, was he in the real world? Or was he still down a layer? Because that ending is so obscure. And it's in a strange room.
Mm-hmm.
A room that we don't see ever throughout the entire piece. And it kind of ends just on him getting horny again and laying on top of Michelle Pfeiffer and kissing her, right? Like, that was kind of the end of it. And...
yeah, I mean, I
wasn't really a resolution, I don't think.
It got to another layer of sort of reality, I guess, because, you know, he's wearing much more pedestrian clothes. You know, they open the windows and it's, you know, gloomy and shitty outside. And it's just a normal German city and not the sort of future projection city where people are all always in suits and evening gowns everywhere they go and just drinking whiskey.
Whiskey.
Zwei Whiskey mit Wasser, bitte.
Der Whiskey, die Erdnüsse, alles künstlich.
Tons of whiskey bars there, huh?
Yeah. Whiskey.
Die zwei Whiskeys, bitte.
Danke.
And so we get to this room where it's, you know, he's just been laying down on a massage table.
Right.
And, you know, having this dream. And what happens is, like, you know, for those who haven't seen this and are not going to watch it, it's like the simulation of Stiller... which was programmed by a real-world person, you know, he switches bodies with them real quick at the very end there, and he's able to escape the Matrix that way, sort of the same way that Einstein did it.
Michelle Pfeiffer switched his brain, right? Or switched the consciousness.
Right.
She did that, yeah.
But that also gets us into, I think, some of the connections to the Matrix. I think... this one isn't quite as obvious as our next movie in terms of like how the Matrix and the World on the Wire were connected the way that it is with Ghost in the Shell. But in World on the Wire, it's like there's tons of little examples. Like after Stiller knows that he's a collection of ones and zeros, he's talking to his chess-loving friend who's always smoking a pipe, and he's talking about whiskey and what he loves about whiskey and all this stuff, and he knows that it's fake, and you know knows that this girl sitting next to him at the bar is also fake and blah, blah, blah. Which kind of is like that Joey Pants scene where he's talking about the steak. And, you know, I know this is just a simulation, but I'd rather have this.
Ignorance is bliss.
And then, later on, they're at that staff meeting or whatever it is, like, what happened with the simulation? And like, they're talking about, like, well, you're drinking coffee and it's the color's brown just because someone programmed it to be brown. Like, what's, you know, there's not a thing there. And that is, you know, sort of paralleled in the conversation with Mouse in The Matrix, where we are talking about, you know, the
tasty
flavor
wheat.
Of chicken and, yeah, the Weetabix and whatever
tasty
else.
Tasty wheat, yeah. It tastes like tasty wheat, but do we really know what tasty wheat tastes like?
Right, exactly. I think the biggest one, though... oh, well, okay, there's also this thing with payphones. So when they're inside in the first level of the Matrix, going into the second level of the Matrix, the way they get out of the second level and back into the first is through a landline payphone type of thing, you know, which they did a lot in the Matrix. You know, the cell phones couldn't get you out, but the landlines could.
Operator.
Yeah, I need an exit fast.
Yeah, and, you know, in World on a Wire, they didn't have cell phones in 1973. It would have all been landlines, but just that imagery of the phone booth was so similar. So much so that I think in a later scene, I think in part two, where that car just sort of drives itself, or the car maybe was driven by the programmers off the road into the river or whatever that was.
With the psychologist killing himself?
Yeah, right before that happens, you know, Stiller is on the phone in a phone booth, and there's that crash zoom while he's on the phone, and it looks so much like...
The Trinity?
When Trinity is like...
Ugh! Yeah, that one looked straight pulled from... You know, and put in the new movie.
Exactly.
But I thought it was great. Yeah.
Oh, and I think the biggest thing is like, okay, we've got the sort of Christ metaphor for Stiller at the end there, where like in the Matrix, when Stiller like switches bodies, or whatever, like the Matrix, Stiller gets shot a whole lot in the chest, lays down, and he's arms splayed out in the crucifixion pose, and then he's reborn in the real world, sort of much. The way that Neo was prophesized to be the one, and then sort of through, I don't know, death and resurrection, the prophecy comes true. But what's crazy to think about is that World on a Wire, like, you know, it aired on German television in 1973. They apparently played it again in the late 70s, but it was never on sort of home video or, you know, VHS or DVD or whatever. It was re-released in the early 90s. As a retrospective on Fassbender's work. So
from like an original film print, or I'm assuming.
Yeah. And you know, what we watched was something that was restored in 2010.
Okay.
And they went back and they grabbed the cinematographer, Michael Ballhaus, to kind of supervise some of this stuff. But, I was sitting there thinking like, God, there's a lot of coincidences here, but how the hell did the Wachowskis see this? If it was so obscure at that time.
Right. But did you just say 2010 was the restoration we watched?
Exactly. So,
way 15 after the Matrix. Or 10 years after the Matrix.
And I think the answer is that like what happened was at the same time the Matrix was being developed and what turned out to be the same year it was released, the American remake to World on a Wire,
13th Floor,
the 13th Floor came out in 1999. It was being developed around the same time. I wonder if there's some connection there where they were able to see it because of that. You know what I mean?
So they basically saw this movie through the lens of the 13th Floor remake, you mean?
No, but rather like while the 13th Floor was sort of being either shopped around or being developed, you know, copies of this movie existed.
Had to have something, right? Maybe a VHS or some sort of something. Yeah, that wasn't widely distributed.
Or their own print.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that they like saw it. Inspired by it, and so that like they watched it and were like, oh, you know what would be good would be like a refreshed version of this with the aesthetic of Ghost in the Shell, foreshadowing our conversation in the future. So much as they were like, it's a research project, we're going to do this simulated world thing. How else has the simulated world genre been impacted? And they probably, you know, tracked it down from there.
Yeah, I think you're right. And in terms of, you know, the way that our inspiring shows usually go, we kind of point out where there's sort of direct ripoffs. I mean, in this one, the only thing I can think of is the phone booth where it seems like it's the same shot.
I would point out two things two other things beyond the list that you already gave, which was a great list. One would be the kind of just suit wearing security forces.
Right.
Right, very much resembling agents. The agents.
Yeah.
And then I'd say, just from a thematic standpoint, overall, despite how it may or may not have been depicted, in some ways depicted in a similar way, this kind of unearned, grandiose love story, right? Mm-hmm. They don't, in each case, neither one of them really have a courting process, so to speak, but they're destined for love, with Stiller and Eva Vollmer, the Michelle Pfeiffer lookalike. It was her, she had loved a different version of him. He didn't really understand it, but he saw it as someone bringing that hand up to bring him out of a situation that was suicidal into the next layer of reality. And it was love that transformed him into that next layer mm-hmm. of reality. And Matrix, that's been the theme throughout the entire Matrix franchise, the love between Trinity and Neo, really solidifying that he is the one and making true his destiny because of Trinity's feelings. And then their love, you know, being the powerful human element that could overcome the imperial machinery of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So love overcoming, love being the key to reality was really the theme of both World on a Wire and Matrix. And I think that's the biggest pull from one to the other, in my opinion.
Nice.
No, that's a good point. I guess I had written down a couple other things that I'd forgotten about too, that I should probably mention, which is like the way they deal with the getting into the next layer down of the simulacrum is by laying in that sort of like therapist's chair, the same yeah. way they do it in the Matrix. They have that sort of, you know, long sort of body chair that they lay in. You know, in this one, they don't get a RCA plug into the head, but rather like they kind of wear a hair dryer, you know, industrial hair dryer that sort of, you know, does the simulations. But also in the sort of in the first part, like what we're supposed to be perceiving as the reality, but is actually part of the first level of simulacrum, we see this room just full of monitors. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me a lot of, especially in Matrix 2, what's sort of revealed to yeah. be the thing in the Matrix 2. But what we actually do see in the Matrix 1, which is when we first see Neo get into that interrogation room.
Yes.
We see that bank of sort of like...
the nondescript monitors. They could be anywhere.
Yeah, those rounded, yeah. sort of 60s style monitors.
6-inch screens. Yeah. or whatever the hell they were.
And that, God, it looked exactly the same in World on Wire.
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I thought that was kind of a one-for-one visual with yeah. this movie. Yeah. And I still don't know, from the perspective of watching the first Matrix, I don't know where those monitors actually are in space. At that point, like, because it makes it seem like, oh, it's the security system of the mm-hmm. building,
yeah, exactly.
right? And we're just looking into that, but it's not, right? Because it's not current. These aren't the kind of monitors that they'd be looking at. Mm-hmm. That's a really cool point. I forgot about that when they're in the office in looking at the simulacrum or looking at the Matrix, their version of it, they also mm-hmm. have all those monitors up. And didn't they also look at that in code? In World on a Wire, just like Tank and Dozer at things yeah. in code, or everybody looks at things in code. Weren't they actually looking at things in computer code? But you know, the reality is built through the code, and
right,
you know,
exactly.
The woman in the red dress.
Yeah.
yeah, she's yeah. mine. You want to take her out, Ava? Let's move on to Ghost in the Shell.
Let's do it.
I haven't seen this in a long time, except for when I was going on my binge of anime back in the day, because I thought that was the next big thing for me. And that was one of them that flew in there, along with Vampire Hunter D and stuff. And I didn't watch this with any sort of, I guess, connection to The Matrix at the time. This was a few years before The Matrix when this was released. But now watching this in that context... wow, there's quite a few similarities there, visually as well as thematically, and some of the things that the characters do. But yeah. Let's chat. This was a good one to rewatch. I'm glad we watched the original version too, and not the 2.0. I heard that's not, right. I don't know, not up to par with this one.
They sort of, I guess, just to clarify on that one, like a couple years after the original Ghost in the Shell, they sort of redid a few interstitial scenes with updated CGI graphics, which I'm not sure why they wanted to do that.
It doesn't fit with the rest of the visual aesthetic.
Right Yeah, I mean, I had never seen Ghost in the Shell, I think, before this, so
cool.
this is the first view here, and I was definitely surprised with it. I had seen clips of it. I knew that, you know, the Matrix had definitely lifted and been inspired by quite a bit of it, but it was fascinating to actually see it and like see how unexpectedly sort of meditative the movie was. You know, I was kind of picturing it to be a little more action-packed, and you know, there's definitely action in it and everything, but it wasn't what I was picturing.
What were your thoughts, Chris? Was this the first time you've seen Ghost in the Shell?
This was my first watch. I made the mistake of starting it up while on a plane, and felt a little self-conscious about the like gratuitous shots of the female cyborg form in yeah. like a glowing green while the cabin lights were off. I felt like felt a bit self-conscious.
Should have put a disclaimer. So I took a break
and I finished it later. But no, yeah, I agree. It was more philosophical and less action oriented than I was expecting going in. I felt like it hit on a lot of those philosophical elements of what is life and you know, what is the definition of life and a lot of the cyberpunk themes in a really interesting way that I was not expecting. I was expecting more of a pop punk take. And it was really more of a philosophical punk tank.
I think based on our other conversations of cyberpunk that this one falls in line more with the definition that we've all come up with, you know, people over time, especially with technology being readily available, they start enhancing themselves and putting new eyes in, new ears, new brains, whatever that is that can enhance them past what the limitations of our human consciousness allows for. And this one really got into that. Everybody in this movie has some sort of cybernetic enhancement of some sort, especially the police or the ghosts in this version. Yeah,
yeah. The investment going into police too, and that high tech, low life. No investment in communities. The community spaces are either mm-hmm. fully abandoned or just salvaged. There's yeah. some depictions. Even there's like one shot that's really beautiful, but it's. You know, kind of the best life that anyone has is these mannequins in a storefront, and they're like above the fray of the city and in this well-lit area
oh, wow.
taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
While then we see, you know, like gunfights through slums and again, abandoned areas of the city that are just in ruin. And so, you know, where is the investment of the future? Where is it going and where is it going today? And how are we along that route?
No, that's interesting. Yeah, and but before we get into the Matrix, it was interesting kind of seeing how many other things that this movie itself kind of was inspired by. I mean, particularly obviously like Blade Runner. You know, obviously it's a big one. Both with like sort of the implanted memories into the androids, and then you know that guy who was like, "What? These seem like my kids and my wife and whatever."
Yeah,
and the one guy who was mostly human but with a radio in his head, his gun they kept making fun of looked exactly like Deckard's gun.
Yeah,
in Blade Runner,
the blaster.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever the hell that thing is. Yeah,
in what had to have been just a coincidence or perhaps a glitch in the Matrix,
deja vu.
Maybe some deja vu was that like and for you, Brian, this is going to be a tough one to relate to. But this movie came out in 1995, and you know, a month or two later, in the same year, Heat came out, and that scene where Major is gearing up to go chase after the Puppet Master, and all of a sudden, all the sound sort of drops out, and all we hear is the soundtrack, and we're just seeing, you know, all these shots of like, you know, the city, helicopters running around. And the music that's playing during that moment, the sort of really sad, almost soft jazz, but with a twangy guitar in it. I mean, like that song sounded so much like a song that plays in Heat. It's very, very strange to me that like, you know, it was just something in the air in 1995. It was a deja vu moment.
Interesting. So not anything like L.A. Takedown, then. It's only like Heat, so I can't relate to any of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I don't think that song made it to L.A. Takedown.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder if there was some inspiration there. But the glitch in the Matrix would be the timing, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because they came out exactly the same time, so it was like right. it was very strange, yeah.
Yeah, we're living in the Matrix, man.
Maybe the sound designer on both movies like, you know, worked on both of them somehow.
This song's fire.
Yeah,
put it in here.
Yeah. This song's fire. Why don't we do something kind of similar?
Do you have any a list of the any Matrix connections to Ghost in the Shell outside of obviously getting jacked in through the back of your neck in a car or wherever that may be.
The depiction of code, certainly, the coming in through the green text code.
The way that the opening credits would be worked through that code, and then, exactly. On the sort of, the green on a black screen. The way that toward the end, Major was fighting that tank, and the tank was like shooting the living shit out of those columns. Like, God, that looked the back thing. Like,
holy shit! Like,
it looked like that scene. Just like tons of like little shots and things. Like, at one point, the guy whose head was hacked that they just chased into that into the river. Before they get there, they're chasing him through a market, and they're just like blasting watermelons and stuff like that. Like, God, the Matrix did that exactly the same way. The tank again, like sort of shooting through those puddles, and we saw those like giant blasts of water. Like, that was happening with the helicopter and
the rooftop Smith. Scenes and
right, exactly. And then just sort of like a lot of little things too, like the high tech machine guided acupuncture. Like when Neo first gets out, he has that. And in Ghost in the Shell, there was some woman who had gotten hacked, and they were trying to restore her brain through a very similar looking device. And then I think a big one is the gender fluidity or gender identity that they express in this with the puppet master. In particular, who has a male voice inside of a female body. And, a lot of those things are expressed a lot more subtly, I think, in the first Matrix as well.
I mean, does that mean we just need to get back into talking about the Matrix here? I mean, we actually took about as much time to talk about World on a Wire as it took to watch it. So we might want to move on to the Matrix, unless anyone has any more Ghost in the Shell to discuss.
Well, I'd say also just another parallel is just overall the chasing down of the anomaly becomes such a big priority that there's no thought as to what kind of damage is done to the city or to the populace in the pursuit of that, right? It becomes the encompassing goal of the entire system, the entire infrastructure, to chase down and eradicate the anomaly. That's the existential threat to the system because of it being an anomaly that's surviving it outside of its own rule system.
Right. I mean, those like sort of political scenes, which for me, I was having a hard time tracking at first. I kept having to rewind it because I was like, there's like so much like dense exposition, being spouted, and like the subtitles weren't up as long as I would have liked for that. But you're right. Like the entire infrastructure of this new world in all its facets we're going guns blazing to try and get this thing
just flipped, right? It was a human infrastructure trying to take down this artificial intelligence anomaly that hit human characteristics versus an artificial intelligence machine infrastructure doing everything it could to take down the human anomaly that had programming capabilities.
Right, exactly.
And they did refer to Neo as an anomaly, I believe, in the second and third film, or maybe they did refer to him that in the first one as well. Don't they just say the anomaly and they refer to him as that?
Yeah, I don't.
Or the program or something like that. It just reminded me of that, and I thought that they said something like that in maybe one of the sequels.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely the Will Ferrell architect guy, mentions
vis-a-vis.
Concordantly.
Erica, open your yapper one more time, and I'm going to architect a world of pain all over your candy ass. Ergo, vis-a-vis.
This is about
concordantly.
I think he calls him an anomaly in the second one, but I don't remember if they did that in the first one, really. But
you don't get as much of the machine's point of view until the second and third and future.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get just a little taste when Agent Smith is, torturing Lawrence Fishburne. Yeah, Morpheus. But you don't get too much more outside of that.
Because I don't think that they introduced that even the Oracle was a program until the next film. I don't think you know that the Oracle is also not a resistance fighter. She's actually part of the system that that is a resistance within the program, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she was there to throw him off his game, and it kind of worked, but then it didn't. I think just to sort of maybe wrap on Ghost in the Shell, one last thing I wanted to kind of talk about was, like, you know, we mentioned sort of the meditative quality of it, and I think a lot of that has to do, you know, not only with sort of the pacing on certain moments and, like, the deeper conversations they're having, but also, like, the soundtrack. I mean, even when we see Major after that assassination in the very beginning, where she totally explodes that guy's head.
Awesome.
as people are looking out the window and, like, oh my god, she's got camouflage on, she, like, you know, covers her face.
Yeah.
And we hear the sort of, you know, the one sleigh bell, like, and then she's gone. You know, there was just, like, you know, just like such great sort of not what you were expecting soundtrack. And I think in certain ways, perhaps The Matrix could have stolen some more of that, because to me, like, some of the weaker moments of The Matrix were how it tried to be very contemporary for 1999, and some of that really shows. But then also, like, I mean, I guess, you know, the way in which the soundtrack sort of plays at a different rhythm than you'd think, I think the animation also does that sometimes, where it's like, you know, like we were talking about with that heat sequence where, you know, it just, because this city, is it Neo Tokyo, kind of like in Akira? I don't know.
Akira, yeah.
But it's like, it's completely flooded, and it looks, you know, post ice caps melting or whatever, and she's riding in this little boat down one of the canals, and she sees what looks like herself up in an office window, and, you know,
the Mr. Anderson moment there.
Yeah, doesn't know what to make of that glitch in the Matrix. I mean, I frankly, I don't even know what to make of it necessarily. Is it she sees the body that she was, like, molded off after or something?
That's what I got from that. I know what you mean. I think so. But I think that there's, you know, 35 books of manga of this, you know, that you could probably dive into if you really wanted to. I don't think this movie even scratched the surface of the Ghost in the Shell lore.
Right.
But let's go on Mr. Anderson.
Now, tanks, now.
Let's go on to The Matrix. I remember this movie being one of my favorites. I had just started college at the time when this came out, and I watched this movie so many times over and over again. There are some cheesy moments that kind of stuck out even more than they did originally for me, mostly the lines of calling him a copper top and telling him that it's their way or the highway.
Yes!
Things like that got me a little irked.
Stop the car. Listen to me, Copper Top. We don't have time for 20 questions. Right now, there's only one rule. Our way or the highway?
However, in general, 99% of this movie is just excellent in many ways. It is a live-action anime, especially watching this with Ghost in the Shell. I saw a lot of the inspiration for Japanese animation and other animated type movies like this. But it felt like they really nailed that in that world. And still, the effects, they were revolutionary at the time. They're still great today. Stuff still works. And I think that the storyline still keeps me on edge and unease about the world that we do live in. So I think it maintains a successful narrative.
I think I would agree with half of that. I think even at the time, in 1999, the first half of the movie came off as, like, super lame to me, like, even at the time. And even when during some of the incredible sequences, and they have that, you know, drum and bass, whatever early EDM music, like, playing, like, it was just, you know, even at the time, it's like, you know, or like what does he say? It's like, I'll strap in. We're not in Kansas any longer, Dorothy.
The pill you took is part of a trace program. It's designed to disrupt your input-output carrier signal so we can pinpoint your location.
What does that mean?
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
Yeah, stuff like that, yeah.
All that, I was like, oh, god damn.
And it's Joe Pants delivering that line, too. Right. I'm sure he had a much better line.
He's a great actor. Lawrence Fishburne, also a great actor, but some of these lines and some of these moments, you think that's air you're breathing? It's just like, it's so corny, you know?
Yeah, or when you turn on your television.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is?
But I think what really saves it is that last, like, 50 minutes of the movie. Basically, from when they leave the Oracle through to the end, the sort of the power and the awesomeness of all that helps save the movie. That, like, if it had continued with its sort of cheesiness that we saw in the sort of first half, you know, it definitely wouldn't have been the classic we know today. But because it leaves on such a high note, it really makes the whole thing work. I mean, like, the action gets nuts. The stakes are super high. You know, everything, you know, all the shit hits the fan. Neo becomes God. He literally becomes the Deus Ex Machina.
He's like, Superman, yeah.
He's Superman. Yeah. He is the one. And so he defeats this storyline. And I guess in that sense, that means what? The whole series has to be over at that point. Because, you know, he plugged in the game genie and he can't die. It's like the whole thing is that he's now invincible.
And also the next move that he's going to make is when he flies away, he's going to let everyone know that's locked into the Matrix what the Matrix is, right? That was part of it, was to let, you know, the everyone that has been pulled with the wool over their eyes, now he's going to, you know, reveal this world.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of camp going on with it. But I think that's a little bit been exacerbated by time and by how popular it is. Mm-hmm. One, we've seen it. We've probably all three of us seen this movie a dozen times over the years.
Sure.
So just through repetition, things become a little bit more silly than an initial watch through.
I mean, it's funny, though. I did remember feeling that at the time, though. Like, when I first saw it, I was like, God, this sucks. Because it ended so well, I was like, oh, wow, okay. You know, the movie actually has something going on here.
But things like the scene, though, like the betrayal scene and and what's her name saying, no, not like this,
not like this,
has become such a meme that now is a laugh moment. Because
it is a very powerful scene, though,
but
right?
This
guy can easily just take out this entire group just by unplugging them because he's back in the real, you know, using his eyes for the first time. No, but... But I mean, you're right, though. It's a very powerful scene from a script point of view and from the storyline. However, its delivery is a little bit, you know, say bye to Switch or say bye to whatever. And then, but I do forgive it. And I think that you're right, Jeremy. I think it's because, you know, there's a really cool setup. And then, there's some cheese once they get up to the Oracle. But once that Oracle scene happens, and Neo is on the path to becoming the one, even though he's told that he's not, that movie just takes off. And it's like scene after scene of just these amazing sequences.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I'd say also, though, you were to go back to your initial theorizing, Jeremy, like this was also a little bit the culmination of the acceptance of camp within a film, within an action movie that took itself seriously, but still had campy elements. Mm.
I think we can handle one little girl. I sent two units. They're bringing her down now.
No, Lieutenant, your men are already dead.
And that started to go away. You know, you had Batman went kind of full camp and then went back with
to
Nolan
to
dark and gritty and real. And camp became something to avoid in the aughts. But this was still a period where camp was acceptable, even in a movie that, by and large, wanted itself to be taken seriously.
Because all in all, this is a superhero story, right?
Yeah.
Or the origin story of a superhero. So, you know, if the basis is comics.
Yeah, and talking about inspiring The Matrix, I think something that occurred to me on this watch through that hadn't occurred to me before, and I haven't seen anyone else make this parallel, but Tim Burton's Batman, I saw so many shots and to start with kind of a palette of black and work light into it in the way that Tim Burton's Batman does. The kind of the two opposing forces being direct foils of one another between Batman and Joker and Neo and Agent Smith. The fetishization of leather, you know, certainly black leather being sure. everywhere.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of Tim Burton's, you know,
that's even more in Batman Returns.
And Batman Returns yeah. within yeah. the Matrix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think what it is like the, like camp, yes. And I totally agree. Like, you know, in the early or sort of mid 2000s, especially, like, you know, camp started to be a thing that you just can't do. Unless it's, oh, is it a comedy or is it a postmodern whatever? Like, if it's an action movie, you have to have it be played super straight and, like, you know, completely joyless. And, you know, the whole world's on the line at all times. And, you know, everything sucks. And, you know, everybody in this world has to be pulling in the right direction to, you know, reverse the forces of evil. And, you know, so these types of popcorn movies become a slog. I mean, it's not the camp that I was sort of rejecting or objecting to in The Matrix. It was just more so that, like, they're going for lines, and remember, this is 1999, this is like post Pulp Fiction, and everyone at that time was trying to do very clever dialogue because they were like, ooh, Tarantino does clever dialogue, we're gonna do clever dialogue too. Here's my clever dialogue, you ready? It's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, you know, it's like they did. It's like, it's not so much that they did camp, but just they did these like sort of bad lines delivered with extreme gravity. And you're like, whoa, it's like it's not working. Had those lines come up with something a little more clever and still been campy, like that would have, you know, just rolled off me at that time. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, now the way we're you were talking about, you looking at it, you know, 20 years later and with the hindsight of like the internet and memification of all the lines in the movie, perhaps some of that would still be a little lame, but it's just more so that, like, sometimes the lines and sort of the campy moments were just like so poorly rendered or whatever in the first half of the movie.
Because I think Smith, Hugo Weaving Smith, I thought delivered some great lines in that movie. And I thought the stuff that his monologues were my favorite parts of the movie that weren't action and gun kata fighting flying styles. I thought he did a great job. I thought whatever he was talking about was strong. In fact, I really was, you know, knowing this movie so well, was looking forward to his monologue, especially the point when he takes out his earpiece.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know what's going on downstairs, and then he gets into, all right, let's lay this down for you, Morpheus. Like, this is really what's happening. I hate this fucking place. I want out of here. You know, I don't want any of this. And that I think that gave a real gravity to him as an antagonist too. He wanted it all gone, and he was an enemy to the Matrix itself, or whatever the Matrix's brain or, you know, cyber consciousness was. He was also an enemy to that. So this guy was the ultimate bad guy that just was the agent of destruction or chaos for the entire idea of the Matrix. So I thought that that stuff was great. And, you know, I think that because of that, you can kind of forgive some of the corniness. But again, if this is based on, you know, the idea of comics, anime, I mean, some of the lines in animes, if you watch those, cheesy as hell. You know, some comic books have some really cheesy lines. However, there's, you know, this great story around it that you can kind of forgive. And maybe it's used as a little bit of a moment of levity or a little resting time here when there's all this seriousness going on. Like, hey, the world, you know, is not real.
No.
This is all a simulation. And the stuff that Elon Musk talks about is actually real, which is the worst fucking nightmare on the planet. You know, so, you know, it's things like that that really, I think, make this movie still, you know, one of my favorites and a gem in the cyberpunk world.
No, totally. How much do you love when we finally first see the real world? And it's just H.R. Geiger's alien ship, his battery pod.
Apparently, Earth has become LV-426, yeah. And the Colonial Marines will be coming down later.
Yeah.
to, yeah. Yeah, it was kind of like one of those canned backgrounds with a green screen that they did for that one, but just put a couch in there.
Yeah.
A really cool red couch in the middle of it. Yeah, that some of that was a little corny. I still think that the using humans as batteries is overall like a corny idea. I just think that they went for it, so it kind of works for this story. But the way that the arms come out and they like take these batteries out and they're just people in pods, you know, being put in, you know, Duracell, whatever. They're like Duracell batteries being put in like the remotes or something, the robot's remotes, you know, like
amniotic chambers.
Well, guys, yeah. I've got bad news. If you thought rewatching Matrix was corny and full of plot holes, you're going to have a real difficult time making yourself watch all of Matrix Revolutions.
Matrix
or Resurrections.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was saying that earlier that I just tried to get through that, especially after watching the original movie, and the entire setup of this new movie is like kind of a meta watch through of that original film. Just, you know, one layer off. And it just confused me more than anything, even though I had just seen a lot of the stuff that they were already showing and I knew the direction it was going. I'm like, why are we retreading, you know, this territory? Why is this happening again? I'm sure that it'll get explained, like you said, in the second half of Act Two. And finally, it actually kind of comes together. However, I'm not sure I'm going to give it that time. But I guess I'll have to. It's a Matrix movie. I got to see it.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, it's like the series had to end after the first one. I mean, like, it really, like, none of the other ones, like, worked in any way. It's like, just from a story perspective, like, what made the agent scary is, like, okay, well, every time you met one, you had to run away. And anyone who didn't run away was in for it. And the only time someone didn't run away was Lawrence Fishburne, like, sacrificing himself so that Neo can get away. And then the second time no one runs away, it's because he's becoming the one. And once he's the one, okay, that's game over. Like the computer can't beat him, right?
Yeah, that's why it's hard to write Superman stories.
And
because you can't kill him, he has no weaknesses.
And so it's like, unless the ideas of the next ones were like flipping the first one on its head, or like, you know, just totally changing the whole way we're dealing with it. You know, a sequel is just not going to work because we already have the cheat code character and, you know, he's invincible. Like, you know, Agent Smith can punch him through 10 buildings and it doesn't matter. You know, he punches Agent Smith through 10 buildings and it also doesn't matter. And you can have as many sort of mud wrestling dance sessions and it's just like, you know, nothing matters in these other movies. I guess it's possible to, like, come up with a way to extend the story, but at least 2 and 3 weren't it.
Yeah, 2 and 3 weren't it. I'd say Animatrix is the far and away the most successful furthering of the Matrix IP, and that, you know, there's other stories to tell within this universe without having to extend the Superman story with and completely abandoning that last scene to write the, like, I'm flying away, I'm going to lift everyone's eyes, and then he never really cares about freeing anyone else.
No,
like it
doesn't continue that in the next
part of the agenda.
No.
Ever. Yeah. Okay.
It's not. Yeah. He just continues to be a freedom fighter, or like the head of the freedom fighters. You know, he was the Achilles that they would send in, you know, and take out the opposition.
Not even freedom fighters, right? Just pure terrorists, because they're just trying to destroy a system. They're not trying to liberate anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Nor did they really have any plan on what to do should everyone become liberated. Like, what are you going to do in that barren real world?
Yeah.
Should everyone become free? You don't have a better solution for them than what's been provided by the Matrix. Yeah.
A billion people all of a sudden have the wool pulled over their eyes or pulled off of their eyes. You think that's going to be a smooth operation? You know, that people are going to go insane potentially, you know, you're going to get a large percentage of people like Neo that say, no, I'm going to reject that, you know, or at least for a while. And which would have been a really cool story, I think.
I mean, look at how many people have rejected reality or created their own simulated reality within just our one layer of Earth that we know about.
Think of how many
in just the last couple
pants
years.
We have. Yeah, exactly.
Well, and if you go back further with religion, depending on what your take of religion is, you can't think that they're all accurate at the same time. So,
but according to dogma, everyone's got the right idea, right?
Yeah,
they all have the one true God. Yeah, I mean, you think about like how this one ends. It's Neo talking in the phone, but he's really just talking to the audience. And perhaps that was sort of designed as sort of another nod to Ghost in the Shell, and how she says something at the end about how, like, they're going to, we don't know what's out there, but we're going to see. And the net is vast and whatever. And
where does the newborn go from here? The net is vast and infinite.
In this movie, like, he has that speech, but that speech is directed at the audience. The audience is supposed to have their mind blown with, like, okay, well, what if this, like, what we just accept as normal is not necessarily the only way to be. And, you know, the movie is extremely, like, as presented as in the first one anyway, is extremely anti-authoritarian with their ability to just, you know, callously kill, you know, cops and security guards and the federal agents, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, and yet if you die in the Matrix, you die in real life. So they are murdering people.
Right, they're killing people.
Yeah.
Because they killed them in the Matrix, right? Yeah, that's...
And so they're out there, like, you know, killing all these authority figures and those who sort of enforce the system that the Matrix is, right? Which in certain ways are sort of like these revolutionary sentiments, I guess, that the movie expresses. And then the idea of, like, the way it ends with this call to action by our good friend Zach De La Rocha, who says, wake up, is essentially, I mean, it's like that idea, like, only sort of was able to exist in the 90s version of The Matrix. And anything in the 21st century, sort of the post 9/11 world, and like the way that, you know, I've talked about before, and you brought up Chris too, where it's like, you know, every action movie and everything else got very sort of serious, self-serious, and you know, no room for irony and everything else, and you know, the Matrix did the same thing, and like the 2 and 3, I haven't seen 4, but in 2 and 3 at least they kind of like are very much what the formula for blockbusters would become. Whereas this one, it's a self-contained movie, and it very much seems like it was intended to be a one and done, but turned out to just be like this massive record-breaking you know, success, and they had to continue it, and they continued it with you know, something that was a little less than what this one seemed to set up.
Well, also, I mean, just, I think the unlimited budget, so to speak, too, that they were given for 2 and 3 after the success of 1 ruined in some ways what they did, because suddenly, you know,
spoiled by success,
they weren't boxed in. And so rather than filling that box with beautiful, again, going back to like the palette being black as a default, you go into those other movies and you're like, you're on a brightly lit highway, you're in, you know, the even ballroom, the dark underground scenes, there's raves going on and laser lights, and you're no longer intimate. And so if you're no longer intimate, having an intimate experience with this huge concept, then it just becomes a video game. It becomes a cartoon, and there's no real stakes anymore, and you don't care as much.
Right.
Although the transport process has altered your consciousness, you irrevocably remain human. Ergo, concordantly, vis-a-vis, you know what? I have no idea what the hell I'm saying.
All right, so next time, we will be talking Scream. I'm very excited about this. We're going to be talking Scream from 1996, Scream 2 from 1997, and Scream 3 from 2000. Scream and Scream 2 and Scream 3. Now, as a sequels guy, Jeremy, of which you are not... Have you seen all these sequels? Have you seen all the Scream films?
No, I've only ever seen Scream 1.
I knew
one.
It. I
and
knew
not
it.
The Scream 1 from 2022,
right?
But the Scream 1 from 1996.
We're going to watch Halloween. Which one?
Yeah, exactly. Are we watching Halloween or the sequel, Halloween?
The direct sequel to Scream. Scream. That should be a fun one.
No, it'll be good. I definitely like Scream, and I've seen it a couple times. I'm curious to check out the other ones. We'll see if they hold up.
Scream 2, I remember quite well. Scream 3, I know I was in college going to the movies, so I don't remember much of Scream 3. Probably slept through most of it or something. At least that's what I'm telling people.
Yeah.
But that should be good. Looking forward to that one.
Absolutely.
Chris, thank you so much again for joining us for, this is your third appearance here on the Grindhouse Institute. Thanks so much for coming again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. The Third Timers Club.
Yeah.
I don't know who else is in it. Maybe
this
Adam
is when you
Furfer.
Get the jacket.
Yeah.
And send that your way.
Looking forward to it.
Well, thank you so much again for joining us and talking more cyberpunk. Where can people follow you?
You can find me on Twitter at Chris J. Michael. Always happy to be on. Always happy to be talking about cyberpunk dystopian futures.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure to subscribe and follow us on all the podcasts and social platforms at the Grindhouse Institute. And if you really want to give us a boost, check us out on Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. It helps us to get noticed. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll be back next week.
Ciao.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.